This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It seems the world is being hit with more big storms. But is that really true? Call them hurricanes, typhoons, or tropical cyclones. Will they get worse in coming decades as the world warms? The answer has been unknown and maybe unknowable with the current records we have and the tools we have, unless someone finds the patterns to how tropical cyclones work. That is the thesis and new paper from Nadia Bloemendaal at Free University Amsterdam. Nadia has won several awards for her work on risks even before completing her doctorate, including one from the big insurer Lloyd's from the Netherlands. Nadia Bloemendaal, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
When planning risk and climate policy, world governments depend on the latest global climate models. Why do those models leave us blind to developing cyclone risks?
Well, in order to properly understand tropical cyclone risk, we want to understand the full spectrum of all tropical cyclones that could potentially hit your location of interest. So that's not just the weaker storms, but we're also talking about the unprecedented, never seen before events that could inflict a lot of damage and a lot of impact. But the problem with climate models and the problem with historical records is that they are typically too short of a temporal length. They're typically covering 30 to maybe 100 years, if you're lucky. They're covering 30 to 100 years, which is just too short to understand all the possible tropical cyclones that could hit Miami or that could hit Houston.
So you developed a new algorithm called STORM. What does that allow scientists and really any analyst who can get the data to do?
As I said, the historical records, they have too short of a temporal scale. But with STORM, we can actually overcome this problem. So what STORM does is it takes the tropical cyclone statistics that we see in the historical records or in the climate models. So think about frequency, intensity, tracks. We take all that information out of those data sets and we plug them into our statistical model. And our statistical model then creates a new tropical cyclone out of that information. And that tropical cyclone is then theoretically possible under those climate conditions from which you took the data out. Now, that procedure of creating a new tropical cyclone is something that you can repeat for thousands and thousands of times. So that means that you can basically blow up the records that you had with new statistically possible tropical cyclones. And that way, we can finally start to analyze and start to simulate those intense tropical cyclones that inflict a lot of damage in any place on Earth. And that's why that's really relevant for risk assessments.
Nadia, you led the new paper titled A Globally Consistent Local Scale Assessment of Future Tropical Cyclone Risk. Why is local scale an essential component of the storms that you study?
Well, the simple answer here is that tropical cyclone risk is highly spatially varying. It's really depending on which location you look at, what that risk profile looks like. So, for instance, if we're looking at the Caribbean, Puerto Rico has a way higher chance of being hit by an intense tropical cyclone than, for instance, Grenada or Bonaire. So you cannot really squeeze them together in your same analysis. They are highly different in their risk profile. And that's why this local scale is so important.
Well, obviously, we cannot measure the future. We can only model it. Did you employ historical wind data as well as sort of a cross-check to your system?
So in a study that we published in 2020, we actually created a present climate, well, 1980 to 2017 climate conditions. We created such a data set with STORM. So we used historical observations and then plugged that into STORM to create this new synthetic data set. And that was a data set that we could validate against the historical statistics. Now, the thing that I need to clarify here is that synthetic models create new tropical cyclones that are theoretically possible. So you cannot one-on-one compare those synthetic tracks. You will not find Hurricane Katrina in there. But you might find a Hurricane Katrina-like cyclone, just to clarify how the models work. So in order to validate, as you were asking, what you can do is you can validate the statistics. So does your model not overestimate intensity? Is it all, you know, within reasonable bounds of what we saw in historical data? And STORM is doing a pretty good job on that aspect.
Well, I think it's really too bad the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change rearranged all the names for the climate future scenarios. We were just getting to learn the older ones, and now hardly anyone knows what the new ones mean. Your group used the SSP5-85 scenario as our assumed climate future. Could you tell us what that means, and how does it compare with the reality of our current emissions?
So SSP585 compares best to what was previously known as RCP8.5. And RCP8.5 is a climate scenario in which we assume that basically no changes are being done to our emission scenario. So we continue emitting high amounts of CO2 and other greenhouse gases every year. To translate that to what does that look like in, for instance, 2100, SSP585 is around 5.7 degrees of global warming by 2100. Now, there's one thing that I need to mention here, and that is that we are not looking at the far future. We are looking at the near future. So that is between 2015 and 2050. And actually, what we know also from the IPCC reports is that in that shorter time span, so in that near future window, the SSP scenarios, the RCP scenarios, they don't really differ that much in their temperature projections. The temperatures really start to ramp up after 2050. So that SSP 585 scenario, you could say in a way that it is what's somehow going to happen over the next few decades, irrespective of which emission scenario you take.
That makes a lot of sense. So your team finds the probability of intense tropical cyclones, on average, more than doubles in all regions, except for the Bay of Bengal and the Gulf of Mexico. Let's take that last part first. It's great news that the storm-battered Gulf of Mexico and the Bay of Bengal, which has been hit so many times, will not double in the probability of tropical cyclones or hurricanes, according to your study. Why are those already stormy places not expected to get worse along with the rest of the world?
Okay, let's discuss these one by one. So in the case of the Bay of Bengal, we found that the climate models that we used as input data for STORM, that they were actually projecting that the Genesis region, so where the tropical cyclone forms, moves closer to the land in the near future climate. It moves closer to the Indian Sri Lanka land mass. And with moving closer to land and the cyclone forming there, there's actually less time for a tropical cyclone to intensify all the way up to category 4 or 5 before it makes landfall. Because as soon as it makes landfall, it starts to decay because it loses its connection with the warm ocean waters. So that is what's happening in the Bay of Bengal. They're moving closer to the shore, and then they have less time to intensify all the way up to those higher intensities. And these results were actually, in a slightly different way, but they are backed up by other literature. So it's not just an artifact from our models. And in the case of the Gulf of Mexico, there's actually something really interesting going on there. What we found was that in the Gulf of Mexico, the absolute number of all tropical cyclone formations is actually about projected to decrease. So we're going to see less tropical cyclones overall in the Gulf of Mexico. The reason that is one of the reasons is because of enhanced atmospheric stability. So with a more stable atmosphere, a tropical cyclone will have a harder time to form. But the problem is, as soon as the cyclone does manage to form, the seawaters, the warmer seawaters, are actually serving as extra fuel for that system to get going. So once a cyclone does manage to form, chances are higher that it's going to be a more intense cyclone. And rather coincidentally, I don't have an exact explanation for this, but rather coincidentally, the amount of intense tropical cyclones that forms in the future climate is then still approximately the same as in the present climate, even though the conditions are less favorable. So, and that has its effect on, yeah, on our estimates that nothing much is changing.
So it won't be as scary as it could be at the Gulf of Mexico, but I don't want to gloss over the first part of that sentence, namely that tropical cyclones on average, the probability more than doubles wherever tropical cyclones are normally found. So that sounds pretty serious for us all.
Yeah, so, well, we do have to say here that we are talking on the effects on the local scale. So it's not that everything basin-wide is going to double, but when you look at it in your town or in your city, yeah, in any region other than the Gulf of Mexico or the Bay of Bengal, yeah, that probability of facing an intense cyclone condition on average more than doubles. Yeah, that's our finding, yeah.
So we know the global average, as you've said, they matter less than what really happens locally. Where does your study suggest the biggest increases in tropical cyclones will strike?
So what we found was that predominantly in the Western Pacific region, such as Japan and South Korea, and in the South Pacific near Australia and, well, the South Pacific Islands, that the largest increases are projected to occur there. And we're talking about a 5 to 10-fold increase in tropical cyclone wind speed probabilities. And it even goes up to a factor 21 near Japan. So that's significant.
A couple of decades ago, scientist Kerry Emanuel suggested America would be hit by more hurricanes as the world warmed, like the number would go up. And then came a surprise, the number of hurricanes did not increase in that period, but the intensity of superstorms did. Where does your study come in on this question? We know storms will have more energy, but will we have more of them?
What we found was that on average, the tropical cyclone wind speeds, so now we're just talking like per cyclone individually, that they are on average projected to increase, and that is predominantly due to the warmer sea temperatures, which serves as fuel, as I said before. And we also see that the fraction of intense cyclones increases in almost all regions except for the Bay of Bengal. So we're pretty much in line with, well, what you just said.
Will the biggest storms get even bigger, or is there a limit approaching? It sounded from my reading of the paper that sea surface temperatures might be a determining factor, but is there a limit, or can these things just get bigger and bigger?
We're not going to go towards like the Hurricane Heist movie type of situations. No, there is an environmental limit to how strong tropical cyclones can get. And that is a factor, an environmental variable, which is known as the maximum potential intensity. And that maximum potential intensity depends on sea surface temperatures and a couple of more environmental parameters. Because of that environment then kind of limits a tropical cyclone to go on to like infinite intensities. But just to give you an idea, hurricanes Dorian and Irma, they were pretty close to that maximum potential intensity for the North Atlantic Ocean in the climate conditions at that time.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Nadia Blumendahl. We're talking about a study on the upcoming future of storms. Your study does focus on Category 3 storms, but what about the really big ones like the Cat 4 and Cat 5? Will they also increase?
The way that our study works is that, we assess return periods. And a return period, you should basically see that as an exceedance probability. So if we're talking about the return period of a Category 3, we're actually talking about the exceedance probability of Category 3 wind speeds. So anything of Category 3 and up. So we're not just looking at Category 3s. We're looking at 3, 4, 5s. And the reason that we took that Category 3 threshold is because at Category 3 wind speeds, already significant damage starts to occur. And that is the information that you need for your risk assessments.
Tell us what these storm models suggest about the future poleward expansion. Do we know how much further up the east or west coast of North America, for example, such high-intensity hurricanes might go in coming decades?
So I cannot give you an exact distance in terms of kilometers or miles. It still depends very much on the environmental conditions, how far a cyclone can actually travel, like in absolute distance. But what we did find in our study is that in the Western Pacific and in the North Atlantic, the location of maximum intensity, so yeah, the latitude at which the tropical cyclone reaches its peak intensity, that is shifting poleward. So yeah, that means also because of those warmer seawaters, that means that warmer seawater is extending further poleward. So it's supporting the tropical cyclone with higher intensities further poleward. So yeah, we are going to see probably intense cyclones traveling further north, but don't ask me exact distances because, yeah, I can't give you that.
It kind of surprised me when Hurricane Sandy hit New York and New Jersey. We don't think of New Jersey as a hurricane area, but perhaps in the future they will get more, and so we'll have to be on our watch for that. You also studied low probability events. Why, when they're so much less likely to happen?
So the reason that we are interested in low probability events is because these are the events that rarely happen, but when they do happen, they inflict a lot of damage. A category 4 or 5 event in your coastal town in America or wherever you may be, getting a category 4 or 5 in your city is what we consider a low probability event. It doesn't happen every year, fortunately not. And it's these type of events, as I said, it's these type of events that inflict the most damage. So that is why, from a risk perception, we want to understand these low probability events and we want to mitigate the risks of these low probabilities, high impact events.
Well, you mentioned cities, and at least 8% of humans live in megacities, and that's where the really big risk as far as insurers go, and just for people's lives, that's where the biggest damage is. Did you study the future of big storms for cities?
In our paper, we did demonstrate how you can use our storm data sets to study tropical cyclone risk near big cities. We did not show that for every single big city on Earth. I probably would need to have another 3 or 4 papers to discuss just that. But what we did do is we examined it for 18 coastal cities, evenly distributed around ocean basins. So yeah, we did do that.
Australia is already a stormy place. What lies in the hotter future for our Australian listeners?
The short answer is that the northeast coast of Australia is located in a region that, according to our study, will face a pretty significant increase in that risk for intense tropical cyclones. To give you an idea for Cairns in Australia, we found that intense tropical cyclone conditions used to have a return period of 50 years, so over the time period 1980-2017. But over the time period 2015-2050, this return period changes to around once every 20 years. So going from once every 50 years to once every 20 years, yeah, that's a substantial increase in your risk right there. And you probably also want to know what exactly does this mean in terms of, you know, what should you do with this information? Well, you should see it as such that, yeah, risk mitigation strategies, they are typically built or designed for a certain return period. So for instance, the building code of your house is built such that it withstands a 1 in 100 year wind speed. Your house should be able to withstand a 1 in 100 year wind speed. That is where that return period comes in. Now, if you have a house that is built for that 1 in 100 year wind speed, and then suddenly that 1 in 100 year is the 1 in 40 year wind speed, you need to update your building code because your risk has increased and your house might be able to be damaged sooner than what it was built for. That's what we're talking about here in terms of risk, that for Cairns, for instance, you need to start looking at your risk mitigation strategies and you might need to update them as government, as policymakers, as whoever is involved there.
Well, another way I would look at it, if you talk about a return period of 50 years changing to a return period of 20 years, that really means that a person might expect to see one big storm in their lifetime previously, might see two giant storms now. Would that be a correct interpretation?
That is one way to interpret it, but don't forget that even the one in 500-year storm could happen at any given time. Any of those return period storms could happen in any given year. Hurricane Irma also had a return period of around once every 500 years, and it happened 3 years ago. That doesn't mean, or 5 years ago by now, that doesn't mean that it cannot happen next year. Like, it has an annual probability of occurrence. So, but yeah, with your annual probability substantially increasing, chances are higher that you are going to experience one of these events in your lifetime.
What does your new study tell us about expected cyclone changes in Hong Kong and the South Pacific?
Yeah, so for Hong Kong, we found that, well, we're going to go back to that discussion on the return periods. So for Hong Kong, we found that intense tropical cyclones used to have a return period of around once every 80 years, and that is going to increase to once every 20 years. So that's a fourfold increase in your probability in the near future compared to, yeah, the last 30 years, which is substantial. And well, for the South Pacific, I already discussed the situation for Cairns in Australia, but also in South Pacific island nations, we see, for instance, in New Caledonia, in Tonga, Fiji, that risk is increasing tremendously. And also more people will be exposed to intense tropical cyclone conditions in these regions.
Talking about flooding and fire, one factor increasing damages and the loss of life is more people are moving to the coast and into the wooded lands. People move into the danger zone. Is it the same with tropical cyclones, do you know?
Yes, that's the very short answer. Yes. So the thing is that more people are migrating towards coastal cities, and also with general population increase and then more people living in these coastal cities, you will see that more people will find themselves in the path of a tropical cyclone in case of an imminent storm. And when more people are exposed and you don't have risk mitigation strategies in place, or yeah, they are outdated in the light of climate change, that means that more people might experience harm or even loss of life. I really hope not. I want to get that straight. But we also might see more damages because people have assets, people have valuable cars and such, and they get damaged by a tropical cyclone. So you see more damages occurring then. Now, the study that we did solely focuses on wind speed, but tropical cyclones, of course, also bring storm surge and precipitation when they come on shore. So if you live closer to the ocean and you don't have a dike or a coastal wall and there's a storm surge coming, yeah, then you might find yourself also facing a flood risk. So it's definitely also the case with tropical cyclones that there are more and more people getting in harm's way.
I was looking at figure 5 in your paper, and it looked like we are seeing upward trends of winds in almost every part of the world. Is it fair to say our children will encounter more windy days, including intense winds, than our grandparents did?
Well, I would like to phrase it a little bit differently. Our children are at larger risk of facing these wind speeds, these extreme conditions. And therefore, my generation and the generation that will come after me, our children, it's really, really important that we start working on getting those adaptation measures in place. We need to mitigate that risk so that they are also safe under future warming. And of course, also drastically cutting back emissions, because that is at the heart of this whole climate change problem. Of course, I don't think I need to say that. One minor comment that I would like to make here, it only takes one severe tropical cyclone to change someone's life. It might be that your grandparents lived through, well, the Galveston hurricane is a bit long ago, but, you know, your grandparents might have experienced a very intense cyclone as well, but the chances that your kid is going to experience that in their life is probably larger than for your grandparents.
It's another reason why we really have to avoid extreme climate change for sure. Now, you helped to develop this new tool to help project cyclones or hurricanes. What's next for you?
For me personally, I am currently involved in a project together with Columbia University in New York, where we work on, you know, further improving our understanding of this tropical cyclone risk and how this is going to change under climate change. We are looking at various climate scenarios, so not just the SSP 585, which I used in this study, but also other emission scenarios, other time periods. And we are hoping to better understand how these different emission scenarios, what effect that has on risk. So that is what I am doing currently now. And if we're talking about, okay, you know, let's take this 10 years from now, where do I want to see this go? Yeah, I really hope that in 10 years from now, I'll be in an active position informing governments and policymakers on, you know, the risk that they are facing on tropical cyclones, but maybe also other natural hazards. My interest is wider than just a tropical cyclone, to help them better understand their risk and implement risk mitigation strategies so that, you know, we can save more people and hopefully reduce damages in the future in the light of climate change.
I could see a future where a climate advisor is a cabinet position in government.
Yeah, I will be very much up for that. Maybe not in the Netherlands, though, because we don't really have tropical cyclones here, but hey, you never know.
I really appreciated the tool that you developed. It took me a while to work through, and then I realized, yeah, this is a really good thing to have. And I didn't realize there was such a hole in the big global climate models until I read your paper.
Yeah. So it's, you know, just to give you a little bit more perspective, you also mentioned Kerry Emanuel in one of your questions. So he built one of these global synthetic models. Columbia University built a synthetic model, and then my model is the third global one. So there are not a lot of them out there right now that are, you know, embedded in academia. Of course, catastrophe modeling companies, they have their own tools, but they are also usually working with, you know, whichever portfolio is interesting. So they also tend to leave out developing countries or, you know, these small island nations that I mentioned in, for instance, the Pacific. So yeah, you know, like building the tool that I did and now couple of years in understanding what exactly it is that we can all do with it. Like, it's just, it's so great. It's so, it opens so many possibilities to better understand that risk. And we're now the first ones to publish that for climate change at a very high local scale, basically. And when you ask, like, now what? I mean, another answer that I could have given is, I just really hope that there will be more of these type of models in the future, because, well, I think you know that not one model is the absolute truth, but if you have a whole lot of models, then the truth is somewhere in there. Like, they converge to the truth. They reach a consensus, and that is what we need. So I hope that my study will also, you know, spark interest with other researchers to dive into this and do a bit more on it.
From Free University Amsterdam, we have been speaking with Research Associate Nadia Blumendahl, and you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. And Nadia, thank you for sharing your time with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure to be here.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.